just like at a concert or a game that you've been at where somebody had a balloon or they had a beach ball and people are passing it around or whatever, it's fun for a little while. However, comma, and it may have been for you already, some of you, after a while, it ain't fun no more.
There you go.
Okay. Trying to keep that up in the air. Now, you did some drawings earlier. Some of that may be some things that you're keeping up in the air. Some plates that you're spinning. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Ed Sullivan's show and the plate spinner. And no matter how good he was, running from plate to plate, spinning them, then eventually one of them started to go wob, 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 boom. And that was the end of the act. But sometimes about letting go, it is actually letting the balloon go to the ground and pop. It is about letting the plate crash to the floor. And what was interesting is, as someone was telling me at the break, life goes on, strangely enough, without you keeping all that up in the air. When we came out, although we both were sure that it would be the end of life as we knew it, in any many ways it was. Strangely enough, even in Germantown, Tennessee, the world continued to turn on its axis. The sun rose in the morning and it set at night. Life went on. Letting go.
Nice.
All right. I am going to be able to see now.
All right. I'm going to talk about a few things that I have found that have helped me along this process. Just leave it at that. We're going to start out with gratitude. When we release, we let go, as we've said a thousand times now, we actually do begin to experience gratitude. It's an amazing thing. And gratitude's not really a feeling from my experience, but more an ongoing kind of thankfulness that begins to emerge. It recognizes the gifts of life that you're constantly receiving. And your perspective begins just subtly, just a little bit to change. Another book that has been very, very helpful to me, The Spirituality of Imperfection. And I'm going to read you a little excerpt from this. It says, consider a teacher, a professor. On the one hand, she could be filled with an arrogant sense of triumph. I hold this position because I'm smart, and by God, I worked for it. And so, I'm here because I deserve to be here. And don't you forget it. We have all met such individuals, and if we're lucky, rarely. But then, there are those teachers who exult in terms of how fortunate I am to be here, and to be able to do what I love doing. Thinking and researching and sharing what I find. So many people went out of their way to help or encourage me as a woman, as a scholar, as a teacher. And without them, so many of them, I would not be here. And the only way I have to say thank you is to pass it on and to give my students as I have been given to. What perspective? Some find scandalous the saying of so many spiritual teachers, the old quote that goes, to those who have, more will be given. Well, it's actually a virtual truism, a self-fulfilling prophecy, because think about this, only the grateful are really able to receive. If you're not grateful, you can't receive. Oh, sure. Gratitude's opposite, which is greed, is the vision that everything is to be gotten Greed and misery go hand in hand, because misery does not know the meaning of enough. Think on that. Those who lack gratitude's vision do not possess things. Things possess them. You think about that. You know people in your life who are possessed by things. As Eric Cotter observed decades ago, now listen to this. This was profound for me. You can never get enough of what you don't really want. Isn't that something? On the other hand, happiness, the joy of living, comes in the experience of gratitude, because this removes us from the center, and thus healing that self-centeredism by revealing that illusion of control. So see, it's all the amazing thing was, when I started studying all these things that we're going to talk about right now, gratitude, humility, tolerance, and forgiveness, they're all like an inner working puzzle that all have to kind of fit together. Not perfectly, none of us ever will, but yet all four are vital to moving on, to letting go, to feeling peace and joy and happiness. We're going to move on to humility. Saint Bernard was asked to list the four cardinal virtues, and he answered: 1, humility; 2, humility; 3, humility; and 4, humility. Again, a little excerpt. One day a rabbi, in a frenzy of religious passion, rushed in before the ark, fell to his knees, and started beating his breast, crying, "I'm nobody, I'm nobody." The cantor of the synagogue, impressed by this example of spiritual humility, joined the rabbi on his knees, saying, "I'm nobody, I'm nobody, I'm nobody." The shamus, who was the custodian, watching from the corner, couldn't restrain himself either. He joined the other two on his knees, calling out, "I'm nobody, I'm nobody, I'm nobody." At which point the rabbi, nudging the cantor with his elbow, pointed to the custodian and said, "Look who thinks he's nobody." Humility, above all, is honesty. True humility neither exaggerates nor minimizes, but accepts. It was pride that changed the angels into devils, and it's humility that makes men as angels, said St. Augustine. Humility is learning how to live and even actually rejoice in the reality of our mixed-upness, our being both saint and sinner, both beast and angel, all at the same time, because that's who we really are. What could be more incongruous, that's a hard word for me to say, than the strange mixture of beast and angel that we are, this spark of divinity in a hunk of nothingness? It's hard to get our minds around all of that. And if we do fall short, that very awareness of falling short implies two related realities. First, we're trying, and second, we need to try again. There is no failure here, for spirituality, as the ancients reminded over and over again, involves a continual falling down and getting back up again. That was such relief to me to realize I could let go all these visions I had of being this perfect person, spiritually, as a mom, as a nurse, as a spouse, all these things that absolutely were making me crazy. That's why humility, the knowledge of our own imperfections, is so important. And that is why spirituality goes on and on and on. A never-ending adventure of coming to know ourselves, seeing ourselves clearly, learning to be at home with ourselves. The great need is for, and I hate this word, balance. When we're down, we need to get up. And when we're up, we need to remember that we have certainly been down and will be down again. And that's okay. That's life. Humility begins with ourselves. We must see ourselves as imperfect, and then we won't be tempted to make comparisons. That's another little pitfall for me. But because humility chooses to look first and only at oneself. First and only. You look at your own defects, your own shortcomings, and it serves as the foundation for a very powerful spiritual reality, tolerance. I'll tell you a little story. One of my children, who is 15, her name is Meredith. She's very, very strong-willed. And she had an experience, what's today? Thursday? Okay, this is the next to last day of her summer experience today. Tomorrow it ends. Meredith decided, without me pushing her or anything, to be a nanny for a family for 3 days a week. And the two little girls that she is nannying, two girls are 9 and 10 and a half. They're holy terrors. It has been way more. She's very strong-willed, but it's been more than she bargained for, that's for sure. And I've asked her a couple of times, you know, is this too much for you? Because I don't want to keep her in a situation where she, you know, was, where it was unhealthy for you or whatever, if they were being, you know, over the top. But she came home the other day and she said, those little girls are so ungrateful. And they have mouth on them and they just don't respect anything I have to say. I mean, she was just going off. And I just sat there and looked at her because this is the very, she was talking about herself. And the more she went on and on and on, I could see the light bulb coming on in her own little mind. It was like, well, I guess I was like that. I just looked at her. And the funny thing was, I took her shopping. That she needed some bras and whatever, I don't know. I took her to Walmart last week. And when we were done, we got in the car, and she looked at me square in the eye. And she said, thank you, Mom, for buying that stuff. I thought, whoa. Those little girls have taught her an incredible lesson this summer. And the funny thing also, I talked to the mom, and you know, I was really kind of checking in with the mom. It made me a little nervous because I didn't know how she was being perceived by those little girls, because she wasn't letting them get by with anything. And so I talked to the mom, and the mom said, Meredith is so respectful, and she has been so helpful and cleaned up and whatever. She is the one that is the biggest slob in my house. I'm like, she's saying these things, and I'm just like not even believing it. And so that just shows you, you know, sometimes the mirror has to be up for us to see ourselves. And sometimes that's the only way that we can really, truly see ourselves. We're going to move to tolerance. Bill Wilson, who's one of the founders of AA, said, honesty gets us sober, but it's tolerance that keeps us sober. We're not talking about a grudging putting up with, but we are talking about a loving identification with. When we accept ourselves and all of our weaknesses and flaws and our failures, we can begin to fulfill an even more challenging responsibility, accepting the weaknesses and limitations and mixed upness of those that we love and respect, other people. And only then can we do the ultimate thing, which is to love and respect the weaknesses, defects, and shortcomings of those we find it difficult to love. So you see, it's building blocks one on top of the other, and I'm seeing this lived out in my own life. Our pastor gave a definition last week, I think it was, of grace that I had never heard before. And it was so simple, and it was profound to me. Grace is accepting that I'm accepted. Mm-hmm. Pretty profound, isn't it? It's like, whoa. We usually tolerate each other by seeking out those whom we share strengths with or commonalities with. And we often think about, even maybe this weekend, we really kind of usually avoid those that we don't feel like we don't have anything in common with, or maybe whose strong points aren't our strong points. Think about AA. It's an unusual group. It's human beings who are together in a group because of shared weaknesses, not shared strengths. And here's the definition of a shared weakness: the shared honesty of mutual vulnerability, openly acknowledged. The shared honesty of mutual vulnerability, openly acknowledged. It's difficult to acknowledge our weaknesses. It's not too difficult to acknowledge our strengths to each other, but weaknesses is a whole different ballgame. But the ironic thing is, it's in those weaknesses, those pains, that we connect. It's usually not in our strengths, because we're usually trying to outdo each other in our strengths. But in our weaknesses, that's where the connection really, really comes. It's in our most human state, it's our weaknesses, that actually make us alike. It's our own strengths that make us different. Those who don't share weaknesses, get this, you think about this in work, find other strengths a threat. Let me say that again. Those who don't share their weaknesses, they're not open and vulnerable, find other strengths a threat. Isn't that the truth? Those who share weaknesses and are actually really vulnerable with each other see in other strengths a hope. A hope that your strength might support me. Isn't that ironic? Again, we've seen so many ironies, so many dichotomies. It's really an amazing thing. I'll tell you another little quick story. I've had a patient in the last 6 months. He passed away last week, and it was very difficult for me. I was telling somebody, usually I don't get overly connected with a family because I can't. I just be in the floor all the time. But this one little man really stole my heart. And his, this little gentleman, he was 80-something, was very abused as a child. And he had five adult kids. The oldest is 60. They're all five of them were between 50 and 60. Very involved in their dad's care, but had never been emotionally connected to him at all. And I can remember, I actually knew the family and had been over to their house years prior. And I can remember this gentleman sitting in front of the TV, always kind of like a lump on a log, just kind of sitting there, never connected, never. And he was like that all the time, even with his own kids. And it was the most amazing thing that last couple of weeks of his life, when all of his defenses were down, he didn't have the energy to keep up any defenses. Those last couple of weeks of his life, he articulated his love for God, which he was always very private about, never articulated that. Told each child how much he loved them and the things he loved about them. And his wife, for the first time, she told me, she said, "I can't believe I've waited all these years, 60-something years, for him to tell me and to tell me the things he's told me and to love me the way he has these last 2 weeks." But see, the deal was, he was so damaged, so hurt, and never had any help getting over that. He could not let that wall of vulnerability down. So he did miss out on so much in his life. But thank God, those last 2 weeks, so much was restored and was healed because he couldn't keep it up anymore. So that vulnerability was the thing that connected that little family at the end of their life. Okay, the last one, forgiveness. A former inmate of a Nazi concentration camp was visiting a friend who shared the ordeal with him. They were there together. Have you forgiven the Nazis? He asked his friend. Yes. Well, I haven't. I'm still consumed with hatred for them. His friend responded, well, in that case, they still have you in prison. Resentment is the poison of the spiritual life. The word resentment means, I thought this was wild, feeling backward. Feeling backward. Resentment. Going over and over an old injury, scraping the scab off that wound. Resentment relishes reliving that pain. We get to be the victim over and over and over again. Now, anger can be an important part of the healing process. I'm sure you've all heard that before. Now, I didn't hear it till after I got out of a fundamentalist religion, because I was taught that to be angry was not the Christian thing to do. So I definitely had some growth to do in that. But I bet everybody in this room probably has heard that by now. But resentment has the capacity to abort your spiritual journey, truly. I mean, you all know people that are so consumed with resentment, and they may even be a Christian, but they're so consumed with resentment that they cannot move on. They're stuck. The anger that morphs into resentment can isolate us, and it can create the illusion that the world has stopped on its the world has stopped in its tracks and has come to focus on our hurts, our desires, and our victimhood. There's no release in resentment. It's truly, I believe, one of the most powerful, gripping things that keeps us from progressing on in our spiritual walk. One Sufi teacher said, if a man removes his bitterness, he becomes human. Otherwise, he becomes an animal. And I see that in my work too. I see people all the time that are, you can tell, they're eaten, they have chosen to be eaten up with resentment and hate and hurt. And the truth is, I see this over and over and over again, we die as we lived. You don't all of a sudden become sweet or compliant or happy. You know, it's all you die as you lived. So quite often we can go in and really see pretty clearly how a person lived. And some people, you know, choose to stay stuck in that. Our sinfulness lies not in anger itself, but in the resentment. That's where the sin is. And when I got that straight, I was like, wow. Okay, so it's not, I'm not sinning if I'm angry. The clinging to and the prolonged attachment to the anger is what is the sinful part. In his book, Is Human Forgiveness Possible? Theologian John Patton examines the New Testament story in which Peter asked Jesus of Nazareth, Lord, when my brother wrongs me, how often must I forgive him? Seven times? And Jesus answered, no, not seven times. I say 70 times seven. Peter's question seems to say, please give me a rule so I don't have to keep dealing with this. How can I know when enough is enough? I want to know what to do instead of having to come to terms with the whole history of our relationship. Jesus' response to the question says, in effect, I'm unwilling to give you a way out of continuing relationship to your brother. Where's the hope? The opposite of resentment, forgiveness. And forgiveness is very, very spiritual. And it can't be willed. You know, I tried that. Forgiveness actually can only be possible when will is replaced with willingness. It results less from effort than from openness. A Seattle University group of scholars did some research with some people who had been blatantly victimized, truly hurt in their life. And the investigators discovered that for those who had no longer harbored the resentment, they were the serene ones, forgiveness did not come easily, but get this was shocking to me, but did come suddenly. These serene ones described not a specific act of forgiveness, but rather a discovery of themselves as having forgiven. They reported that they couldn't force the experience. One person said, "The harder I tried to forgive, the more I seemed to resent." Realizing this, they stopped trying to forgive, and instead, and this is a quote in this book, they just sort of let go. After varying intervals of time came the astonishing discovery that the resentment had disappeared and that they had somehow already forgiven. Isn't that something? With AA, this understanding of forgiveness is conveyed in a very straightforward fashion. When some hurting person approaches an AA sponsor or friend to complain of being victimized or to moan that he cannot get rid of a resentment because he feels unable to forgive, the usual advice judiciously offered runs, "Well, I'd say pray for the son of a bitch." And astounding as it may sound to the outsider, it works. Time after time at meetings of AA, experiences of forgiveness are detailed in just such stories. "I just couldn't forgive the so-and-so, but my sponsor said pray for the SOB, and I did. And would you believe it, one day I realized that I no longer felt resentment. Somehow, the whole thing didn't bother me anymore." The prayer that most usually works is the only prayer often possible. I love this part. "God, please give that SOB what he deserves." And so long as no one presumes to suggest what he deserves means, amazingly it works. Okay. Remember that we talked about tolerance and that our vulnerabilities, our imperfections, are the things that connect us much more than our strengths do. And it's the same with forgiveness. Many times the event that may allow us to forgive is to be forgiven. Sometimes that's the best teacher. Teresa of Lisieux, I think that's how you say it, said, "Prayer arises, if at all, from incompetence. Otherwise, there's no need for it." Prayer does heal brokenness, and brokenness within that is unforgiveness. A spiritual shift begins to take place when you begin to forgive. We stop blaming others and we begin to accept responsibility for who we are. It sort of shifts that focus off them or whatever the situation is, and we begin to take responsibility for who we are. We're forgiven only if we're open to forgiving, but we're able to forgive only by being forgiven. Get this. We get only by giving, and we give only by getting. That same little duality that we see over and over and over again. Forgiveness is not an explanation. Explanations have to do with exploring causes. Forgiveness, on the other hand, has to do with letting go of the past, giving up control of the past, and refusing to be controlled by it. That's important. We have to actually make a decision. I'm not going to be controlled by this. Forgiveness is not the same as forgetting. A German philosopher, Arthur Schopenhauer, I think is how you say it, said it best. I love this. He says, "To forgive and forget would mean to throw away dearly bought experience." The offense is exactly what must not be forgotten. It is by facing the pain and working through it that the forgiveness comes to fruition. Life is painful, often very unfair, but it is often in the depth of our agony and hurt that we actually find our way. Yep. Okay.
What time is it? What time is supposed to end?
11.
Okay. Some of you looked at this table over here as you were coming back from break. I encouraged you to. Those of you that didn't, there's various items on there that could be symbolic again of some of the things that Heather talked about, areas of maybe unforgiveness or like what we've been talking about last night and today, things that you need to let go of, things that you can't leave alone. I encourage you, those that didn't, as you leave today, to look at those items. And as I told the other group, if something particularly draws your eye, you focus on it. And don't just say, oh, well, I think there's jelly beans over there. I like jelly beans and that. That's just the thing that got my eye. There's nothing in it. Be open to the Holy Spirit. Speaks in metaphor and symbols many times. That might mean something to take a look at, because after lunch we're going to have a service of letting go. So we just have that there to just maybe spur something, to see if that symbolizes, that means something to you. Also, the things that you did in your artwork regarding the things that you can't leave alone, the things that you can't explain, and you feel like it's going to make you nuts if you can't figure it out. I'm a good one. I think if I can figure it out, I can get on top of it and I can control the situation. And I've had a lot this last year that I just couldn't figure out. And I realized the only person it was making sick was me and those around me sometimes. And so I let go that I can't figure it out. So I want you just, as you're having lunch, just let those things come up. And so when we have our service of letting go in the afternoon, maybe there's something that needs to be, at least symbolically, the process of letting go. I would like to say, with Heather's words about tolerance, humility, forgiveness, that I had a situation in the hospital where I saw that all in one scenario. A woman had twins, a little girl, a little boy. Little boy was anencephalic. For those of you that are not aware of that, it means he was born without a brain. He wasn't supposed to survive very long after birth, but he survived a couple of days. He was absolutely the most angelic, beautiful child I'd ever seen in my life. He was mesmerizing. His face just pulled you in. He had an otherworldly type of look. The staff and the nurses and everybody was very disturbed by this. We were waiting for him to die. We had a healthy baby. And in this woman, this mother, and the whole family, I saw humility. I saw the acceptance. Many times in our Western society, we put such a utilitarian value on people. You know, it's based on what you can do, and you know. So we dismiss the elderly, we dismiss various people because they don't seem to serve much purpose. This woman came to me and said, is something wrong with me? Because, you know, I've had some friends, and the family was all operating the same way. But she said, I've had some friends come in, and they want to know what's wrong with me. And some of the nurses had said the same thing. They say, I'm not breathing appropriately. I said, oh, really? And she said, but you know what? She said, you know, they say, I'm in denial. Because they were enjoying the little girl. And guess what? They were enjoying the little boy. Everybody held him. Everybody bathed him. He had cute clothes on. He wasn't supposed to eat. He ate. We celebrated. He wasn't supposed to poop. He pooped. I walked in one morning and grandmother said, he pooped. I went, yeah. We celebrated him. She said, is something wrong with me? Because they said, I'm not grieving. She said, he's not dead. And we celebrated every moment and we loved on him. Humility. And as that child in those days, that family, things that have been held between the husband and the wife, the mother and the grandmother. Forgiveness happens. And tolerance happens. Quite a valuable young life, young Master Michael had, wouldn't you say? So those things are real and lived out, and sometimes we hear so much talk about these words that they lose something. And certainly I saw gratitude lived out in a way I'd never seen in my life. Every second of his life, we were grateful for. And all that seemed to be a very real and profound experience. There was an authenticity, another one of those kind of almost seminarian words, you know, to be authentic, to be real, you know. But then you're in people's lives like that, and you go, oh, this is what authentic is. It really means something. It's real. I'm going to read you a story that many of you will be familiar from, our section of the Velveteen Rabbit, before we leave and go into lunch. The skin horse had lived longer in the nursery than any of the others. He was so old that his brown coat was bald in patches, and it showed the seams underneath. And most of the hairs in his tail had long been pulled out to string his bead necklaces. He was wise, for he had seen a long succession of mechanical toys that arrived to boast and swagger and by break their mainsprings and pass away. He knew that they were only toys and would never turn into anything else. For nursery magic is very strange and wonderful. And only those playthings that are old and wise and experienced, like the skin horse, understand all about it. What is real? Asked the rabbit one day. Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle? The skin horse said, real isn't how you were made. It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. Does it hurt? Asked Rabbit. Sometimes, for he was always truthful, the skin horse. When you are real, you don't mind being hurt. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up? Or bit by bit, asked Rabbit. Skin Horse said, it doesn't happen all at once. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't happen often to people who break easily, or who have sharp edges, or who have to be very carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off. And your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby indeed. But these things don't matter at all, the skin horse continued, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand. I suppose you are real? Asked Rabbit, and then he wished he had not said it at all, for he thought the skin horse might be sensitive. But the skin horse only smiled. The boy's uncle made me real. That was a great many years ago. But once you are real, you can't become unreal again. It lasts for always. The rabbit sighed. He thought it would be a long time before this magic called real happened to him. He longed to become real, to know what it felt like, and yet the idea of growing shabby and losing his eyes and whiskers was rather sad. He wished he could become it without these uncomfortable things happening to him. Yeah. Is it now break for lunch? It is, Lou? Oh, but no, what she said, no? I'm going to read that other story that I wanted to read last time. We're going to squirm a little bit. Okay. I'll do that one.
I didn't get to give you a treat that I wanted to give you last night because I had calculated the time wrong. So I'll give you this little treat to end with. Another one of my favorite authors, Naomi Remen. Anybody read her before? Oh, she's awesome. Okay. Claire came into my office. She was in a beige linen suit and a white silk blouse. She appeared flawless, competent, and totally in control. In comparison to her elegance, my waiting room looked shabby. When I said her name, she rose and she shook my hand. Without another word, she followed me into my office and folded herself into a chair, crossing her long, beautifully shaped legs at the ankle. I settled myself opposite and smiled at her, and without any warning whatsoever, she burst into tears. The contrast between her tears and her self-possession was so extreme that I was caught completely by surprise, and for a moment I was stunned. And then I reached forward and took her hand between my own as she sobbed. And we sat like that for a long time until she cried enough. Turning a tear-stained face toward me, she commented, "How embarrassing. I have not cried in years." "These are special times," I said. She nodded. "Would you tell me about it?" I asked her. She had come because 8 weeks before she had undergone surgery to remove her right breast. After much discussion, she and her doctor had made this decision together. She felt certain that it was the right choice, and she had healed nicely. And how has this been for you?" I asked her. "I don't know," she told me. She was in her late 20s, unmarried, and successful as a businesswoman. Until her surgery, she had worked out daily and had been very proud of her body. Men had always found her very attractive, and having a man in her life was important to her. She had had many lovers, mostly colleagues she had met in the business world, but that's over now, she told me. "I could never allow anyone to see me disfigured like this." After the surgery, she had ended her relationship with the two men that she was seeing. Both had accepted it gracefully and moved on. No one at work, and none of her friends even suspected that she had cancer, she told me. She had done it entirely alone. So obsessed had she been with secrecy that she told everyone that she was going on a vacation to Europe and had even made arrangements to have cards sent to them from abroad. Even her parents did not know. But she was here because the pressure of keeping this secret had become too much, and she needed a place to talk and to be herself. "I can't come often," she said. "People would begin to suspect." "Well, come whenever you need to," I told her. For the next few years, I saw her every 3 or 4 months, and on the surface, her life was much as it had been, except that she had lived as a celibate, putting all her energy into her work. During one of her infrequent visits, I had called this to her attention and asked her if she planned to be alone for the rest of her life. "Well, only for 5 years, Rachel," she told me. Seeing my look of surprise, she explained that her oncologist was very conservative and that she had picked him because she too was conservative. Early on, they had discussed a breast reconstruction. He had encouraged her to put off having the surgery until the 5th anniversary of her diagnosis. "And this is so that any reoccurrence can be easily seen?" I asked her. She nodded her head, "Yes. And after 5 years, the chances are that I will be home free." A little more than a year before this important anniversary, we had one of our sessions. And during the hour, she told me that she had gone to an opening at an art gallery and had struck up a conversation with a painter who had asked her to join him for a cup of coffee. "He's a very attractive man, but obviously totally unsuitable as a lover," she told me. So I said, "Yes." "Because he's unsuitable?" I said, puzzled. "Well, I thought we could become friends," she had replied. Surprisingly, she said she had a good time. "Will you see him again?" I asked her. Yes, I think so, she told me. He's very good company. So 3 months later, when she returned for another session, Peter's name came up in our conversation over and over again. They had gone to the zoo. She had visited his studio and had been very impressed with his artwork. By now, she had met many of his friends who were also artists and sculptors and found that she liked them very much. It had surprised her to discover that she fit in so well with these people and was even more comfortable with them than with people she knew from her work. Perhaps it's because you are creative yourself, Claire, I told her. Business can be as much an art form as paint or stone. She thought this over for several moments. She had never seen herself in this way before. And after about 2 months, she called to schedule an urgent visit. She came into the office looking somber. It's the end, she told me. Thinking that perhaps she had suffered a recurrence, my heart jumped into my throat. But this was not what she had meant at all. Peter left a message on my voicemail inviting me away for the weekend. And I'll have to tell him now, she said. It's over. Relieved, I said, well, perhaps once he knows, he might not feel that way about things. I doubt it, she replied. He's exactly the wrong sort of man for me. Beauty is his whole life. He'll be completely repulsed. When will you tell him? I asked, my heart sinking. Tonight at dinner, she said. Well, call if you need to, I told her. I found myself thinking of her all evening, but she didn't call. As the weeks went by, I continued to wonder what happened, but I resisted calling her to see how things went. As was her way, she came in again 3 months later. In response to my questioning look, she said, I was wrong. He still wants to be friends. It turned out that Peter wanted to be more than friends, but Claire had refused. Her body was too ugly, too maimed. My fifth anniversary is less than 6 months away, and I will have my reconstruction, she told me, perhaps then. So she went on to tell me her plans. She had scheduled the date of her reconstructive surgery more than a year ago and interviewed several surgeons and some of their patients before deciding on the surgeon she would use. She had arranged the vacation time at work. As her insurance did not cover the surgery, she had begun saving the money for it right after her mastectomy and over the past 5 years had put enough away. It would be very expensive and difficult, but she hoped it would return her to her wholeness. She looked down at her hands, clasped in her lap for a few minutes, and then she looked up. I hope it works, Rachel, she said. I was not sure, but I thought there might be tears in her eyes. I did not see her again until a few days before her fifth anniversary. She came in looking excited and happy. I was delighted to celebrate this milestone with her. And I asked her about the upcoming surgery. She smiled and told me she'd canceled it. I looked at her in surprise. What? I asked her. She returned my look for a long moment, and then slowly she unbuttoned her blouse and shrugged it off her shoulders. She was not wearing a bra, and her left breast was exquisite. But its beauty was overshadowed by the radical change in her body. Her mastectomy scar had been covered over with a mass of tiny, exquisite, tattooed flowers. They looked real. In the most delicate of pastel shades, they climbed to the top of her right shoulder. As she turned away from me, I could see that they fell across it and down her back, as if scattered by gravity or the wind. She stood, pulling her slacks down over her hips. Her body was beautiful. One little tattooed flower had come to rest in the small of her back, and another lay against her right buttock. Under it was initialed P. My mouth dropped open in shock, while at the same time I experienced a pang of envy. She was indescribably erotic. Men encountered women like her only in their dreams. Shrugging back into her blouse and buttoning her slacks, she sat down again, laughing aloud at my look of astonishment. Isn't it beautiful? She said. Peter painted it, and we went to Amsterdam to have it done. And then we used the money I had saved for the surgery for a honeymoon. "I'm so happy, Rachel," she said, blushing slightly. "My husband has convinced me beyond the shadow of a doubt that anything of real beauty is one of a kind." Lunch.